pleasure for me to introduce Robert Fulcher to you. He's a student of our department here, and he is a member of the Wiener Forum für Analytische Philosophie, which is a group of students organizing activities in analytic philosophy. His interests are analytic philosophy, philosophy of language, history, and philosophy of science, and we're looking forward to your talk.
Thank you. First of all, I give you a short overview of what's going to happen. I will discuss in my talk two different ways of spelling out the definition of rigidity for general terms, and I will also show the problems these two definitions and approaches have. My aim is to achieve a better understanding of the discussion in current philosophy. So let's start right away. The view which takes proper names and some definite descriptions to be rigidly designating expressions, meaning that they designate the same object in every possible world in which it exists, is nowadays widely accepted in the philosophy of language. However, in his Naming and Necessity, Kripke mentions several times that, according to his analysis, certain general terms, which means in the main terms for natural kinds, bear an important analogy in their semantic behavior to that of proper names. To be exact, I quote two passages. In the first, he says, according to the view I advocate then, terms for natural kinds are much closer to proper names than is ordinarily supposed. And the second says that, my argument, which means, of course, Kripke's argument, implicitly concludes that certain general terms, those for natural kinds, have a greater kinship with proper names than is generally realized. So, being much closer to proper names and having a greater kinship to them seems to be the only basis for the application of rigidity to general terms explicitly given to us by Kripke. Whereas the definition of a proper name as rigid designator is fully spelled out, corresponding arguments for the application to general terms are missing. Thus, from then on, philosophers have tried to spell out the definition of rigidity for general terms, which either first uniformly applies to general terms for natural kinds while leaving out artificial kind terms, second, explains the similarities in semantic behavior to proper names, and third, explains the necessity of theoretical identity sentences containing such terms, or even all three of them simultaneously. These efforts have separated the philosophical community into two parts corresponding to the two major proposals for such a definition. On one side, we have a view according to which for a general term to be a rigid designator means to designate the same kind in every possible world. And on the other side, a view which takes a rigid general term to be a predicate which expresses an essential property of the things it applies to. I will take a closer look on them in the following. However, it should not be suppressed that there is also a third view according to which rigidity is declared undefinable for general terms and thus should be restricted to proper names and some de facto rigid descriptions. Advocates of this view include Scott Soames and Stephen Schwartz. Indeed, Soames is the only one I know so far who explicitly denies the possibility of a definition which fulfills all three conditions stated above. He discusses the issue at length in his Beyond Rigidity from 2002, which constitutes something like a cut, for he explains condition 3, the necessity of identity sentences containing such terms without reference to the supposed rigidity. I will come to that in the last section, but now let us start with the sameness of designation account. Sameness of designation views have been advocated and criticized in different varieties. The most important problem for the view, the so-called trivialization problem, will be considered in the next section. In the following, I will concentrate on a paper by Laporte, which contains a classic formulation of the position. But first, let's consider what would be an intuitive answer to the question what the rigidity of general terms consists in. Perhaps the most natural answer would be to say that these are terms which have the same extension in every possible world. One could be inclined to think that, since proper names designate the same object in every possible world, so does a rigid general term. The only difference being that the proper name refers to only one object, while the general term is true of more than one object. But of course, so construed, the view is a non-starter, because the particular object satisfying any in-place predicate may change from world to world, and so may the extension of the corresponding general term, which means one object may exist in one world, but fail to exist in another world. Therefore, spelling out the rigidity of a general term as having the same extension in every possible world would have the consequence that no general term comes out rigid, since it will designate a different extension in every possible world. The mere possibility that there are, for example, tigers other than the actual tigers rules out this proposal. Therefore, proponents of the sameness of designation view change the designatum from a set of concrete objects to an abstract object. A rigid general term is said to designate the same substance, kind, property, universal, class, or whatever in every possible world. Thus, Laporte says that a kind designator designates the same abstract kind or other entity in every possible world, even if the concrete individuals instantiating the respective kind and comprising the term's extension vary from world to world. So what explains a general term's rigidity is that despite the fact that its extension varies from world to world, it has a constant denotation, constant over a set of possible worlds. The kind picked out by the term is the same in every world in which it exists. Now I suggest we examine this proposal by means of our three conditions for a rigidity definition. Let's start with the second one. The definition should explain the similarities in semantic behavior between general terms and proper names, especially when it comes to contexts involving modalities and thus talk of possible words. How does Laporte's proposal fit into that? Well, one important argument for the rigidity of proper names is due to their being non-descriptional. Whereas Aristotle designates the same man in every possible world in which he exists, the description, "the teacher of Alexander the Great," does not so. There may be worlds where in fact any other person is the teacher of Alexander and so is picked out instead by the description. Similarly for general terms then, or so goes Laporte's suggestion. Honeybee, he says, seems to pick out the honeybee kind rigidly. The insect species that is typically found for honey is not the designator that picks out its kind in every possible world. So it seems as if his account can make good sense of the difference between descriptive and non-descriptive expressions, and in this respect satisfies our second condition. Rigid general terms designate the same abstract entity in every possible world in which that entity exists, and it does so because the terms are not synonymous with any description. It follows that also the third condition is satisfied, since the non-descriptionality of the term honeybee explains why it picks out the same kind in every possible world, and therefore why identity sentences containing it and another rigid kind term turn out to be necessary if true. So if Laporte's arguments are correct so far, which of course is heavily doubted by others, it seems as if our rigidity definition has good prospects. 2 out of 3, but now the trouble begins. I will now introduce the trivialization problem. Consider the first condition. What is demanded is a definition of rigidity for general terms that should naturally distinguish between terms for natural kinds on one side and terms for abstract or artificial kinds on the other. Kripke restricts his theory to specific terms like mass terms, count nouns, terms for natural phenomena, and so on. With this in mind, I think it will be not too much to ask for a definition of rigidity that entails a difference between rigid natural kind terms and non-rigid artificial kind terms. But this is something that Laporte's account cannot do, for according to his definition, every simple general term will come out trivially rigid, since for any general term, even for any predicate, there is a unique universal which can be interpreted as designatum of the term in every possible world, which has the unwanted consequence that general terms like table or slippers will rigidly designate tablehood or slipperhood respectively wherever the kinds exist. Thus, Schwartz, in his criticism of Laporte, says, "The difficulty for Laporte really comes down to the fact that no one is sure what kinds and properties really are, how many there are, and how to identify them. With singular terms rigidly designating individual physical objects, we do not have the serious problems." But despite the fact that this account is metaphysically uncomfortable, there are people who can live with that, it is even more questionable what the point of emphasizing rigidity of some specific general terms could be when nearly every general term turns out rigid anyway. This failure was pointed out by a number of writers, and it is a weakness shared by all senders of designation views. Thus, recent discussions mainly concern the question whether an account of sameness of designation is available, which does not trivialize rigidity, and many different proposals for such a version approached. I cannot go into detail here. For our purpose, it is just fine to know the account in outline and the most important objection to it. I will now leave off here and come to the second approach to rigidity, the essentialist predicate view. A classic formulation of this position comes from Cook. He says, so if being a cat is an essential property, something Kripke can plausibly be taken to believe, nothing that is in any possible world a cat can exist without being a cat. Cat designates all those objects that cannot exist without being cats. It designates those objects wherever those objects exist. Cook tries to rescue the intuition that general terms designate concrete objects rather than abstract entities. The world relativity of the extension of a term like cat is encompassed by saying that the term designates every single cat in every world in which it exists. Since the manifest physical properties of cats can vary from world to world, but their being cats cannot, it is guaranteed that an object being in the extension of the term cat in the actual world will be so in any world in which it exists, just because being a cat expresses an essential property, or so is argued by Cook. His approach makes explicit reference to the notion of an essential property, which of course has central place in Kripke's overall metaphysical views. This also could serve to explain why it should be important for us to restrict rigidity solely to natural kind terms, for Kripke says that, in general, science attempts by investigating basic structural traits to find the nature and thus the essence in the philosophical sense of the kind. Also, the relevant identity sentences considered by Kripke are concerned solely with so-called theoretical identifications like water equals hydrogen x oxygen or gold equals the substance with atomic number 79. It is not at all meant, at least not obviously, that the theory should apply also to artificial kinds and therefore be understood as a theory about the designation of universals. All this seems to be captured by Cook's proposal. Unfortunately, his account as presented in the short paper from 1980 leaves many questions unanswered. Therefore, I will use a slightly modified version of a formulation of the doctrine provided by Soames. A variant of this approach is so-called rigid application advocated by David and Stirani, but I will stick to Soames' version. The essentialist predicate view thus is characterized by the following doctrine. For every general term F, F is rigid if and only if F applies to an object O in the actual world implies F applies to O in every possible world in which O exists. Surely this is the case with, say, type. Any actual existing tiger could not have failed to be a tiger. He could have failed to instantiate some of its actual physical properties, even to be four-legged or to be striped or anything else, but he certainly could not have failed to be a tiger. This is in accordance with Kripke's metaphysical position. Now let me remind you about our three conditions stated above. Are they satisfied in the essential predicate view? The first condition, we could say, is at least partially satisfied in that, for example, the general term bachelor will not come out rigid on this proposal since no bachelor is necessarily a bachelor. Although some standard objection to this view broached among others by Zernon is that it makes color terms non-rigid since there are objects who are not necessarily red or yellow, at least the account does not lead to trivialization of rigidity as does the sameness of designation view. The second condition is also satisfied, since the non-descriptionality of such terms, in which their similarity to proper names consists in, nicely fits into the account. A description of an object in terms of its conditioned properties will never be rigid. So again, we have two out of three, but again, a problem threatens the account, for it is not clear whether it can give a sufficient explanation of the necessity of theoretical identity sentences containing rigid general terms. I will come to that now. The following objection to the essential predicate view was put forward by Scott Soames. The argument goes as follows. First, take any theoretical identity sentence, say water equals hydrogen oxygen. According to Soames, such an identity is represented in a first order language by a quantified B conditional. thus for all x, x is A if and only if x is B. The predicate symbol A, of course, stands for being water, B for being hydrogen, oxygen. If our theory is correct, then A applies to water in every possible world in which it exists, as does B. Therefore, if sentence 1' prime is true, then necessarily so, thus becoming for all x necessarily, and so on. But now Solms argues that this is not what we wanted. According to Kripke, the truth of an identity sentence, together with the fact that the terms involved in that sentence are rigid designators, implies that the statement is necessary. However, Solms, in making a move in formalizing such sentences from a pair of singular terms flanked by the identity sign to quantified B conditionals, raises therefore an important question concerning the necessity involved, the re or the dicto. If Solms is right, sentence 2 does not preclude the possibility of a non-actual existing object, which is A but not B. And therefore the sentence 2 would not be necessary if true. To get the desired conclusion, we would need this. I consider this to be the main argument against the essential predicate view, since if it is correct, then one of the most important tasks for a definition of rigidity, explaining the necessity of theoretical identity sentences, cannot be fulfilled. Therefore, as Solms concludes, either the essential predicate view is defeasible, or Kripke is wrong on the modal status of theoretical identifications. And since he does not like to suggest the latter, he rejects the essential predicate view. Michael David, on the other hand, simply declares condition 3 to be secondary work for a definition of rigidity, and he accepts Solms' argument simply as an exception of the otherwise great explanatory impact of the concept of rigidity. Again, I cannot go into details, but as always in philosophy, that was certainly not the final word. We have seen a pair of competing views on how to define rigidity for general terms. My aim was to show the merits, perhaps the intuitive appeal they have, and the fallacies of both accounts. When we remember our three conditions, we see that the only one which was satisfied on both accounts was the second one. It seems as if we have a good understanding of the similarities between the semantic behavior of natural kind terms and that of proper names, although we can't spell out the notion of rigidity which is consistent with the other two conditions. Perhaps Solms is right, therefore, and we should concentrate on the similarities between these kinds of expressions without trying our hands at the notion of rigidity, which does no theoretically interesting work. I can't decide this question here, but maybe what we have achieved so far makes the decision easier in the future. So, thank you.